Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show. In China, COVID cases remain relatively few by global standards. Still, the government lockdown in the city of Xi'an has been one of the country's strictest.
There were stories going around about people trying to escape Xi'an. One guy rode one of those public shared bikes for 8 hours in the middle of the night, and another one walked for days.
Also today, Chinatowns across the U.S. confront an identity crisis.
The older businesses are, by and large, ready to retire. Without younger business coming in, then there's no future.
And working from home seems to be here to stay. It's more convenient. It can also bring risks.
People who go back to the office are getting the FaceTime with the bosses and all that sort of thing. They are most likely to get the pay rises and to get the promotions.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Let me offer you a disturbing number, 488,000. That's how many new COVID cases emerged in the U.S. just yesterday. New York City alone accounted for more than 32,000 of them. If you take the northern Chinese city of Xi'an, which is larger than New York, they're reporting just slightly over 1,000 cases, over nearly this whole month. Just a whiff, though, of COVID was enough to send Xi'an into a full lockdown more than a week ago. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai joins us for an update. So China has been touting its strict zero COVID policy, Rebecca. Can you take us back to how this latest outbreak happened in Xi'an?
Well, China is very strict on managing COVID within its borders, and no one is completely sure how these cases went undetected. But the source of this outbreak seems to be an early December flight from Pakistan, which flew into Xi'an, a city of about 13 million people. And in the past 5 days, there have been 100 or more new cases every day. And as you said, the city has been locked down. People are posting photos and videos online that show the city streets completely empty. I spoke to Jin Ye as she was waiting in line for a COVID test right outside of her apartment building. She's showing me the line to get tested. Frontline volunteers are letting people go outside once a day just to get tested. And everyone must stand 6.5 feet apart. The line goes fast, she says. She's usually back inside within a half hour. She told me this lockdown feels like a forced vacation. She works as a violin repair person with her husband. And with the lockdown, she's unable to work because nobody can drop off their violins to get fixed. Her sister and her niece can't even return to their home across town, so they're all quarantining together.
The lockdown in Xi'an has been going on for more than a week, Rebecca. How is the local government managing things?
Well, things got off to a bad start last week. The city's health code system, which is used for contact tracing, was completely overloaded by residents trying to use it. I talked with several people, and they told me the biggest issue they're having now is food supplies. People can't get out to shop, and restaurants and delivery services are mostly down. A lot of people are upset. Today at a press conference in Xi'an, a reporter asked government officials about the complaints. The government official is promising they're working hard with surrounding provinces to secure food supplies for Xi'an residents and asked everyone to be patient. I spoke with a woman named Shi Xiaojin. She says she understands the logistics are hard to manage, but she's frustrated. We can't even buy food now, she says. We're supposed to get a delivery, but it's been 3 days. Her husband is a frontline volunteer helping people get tested and is working around the clock. So she's at home with her 15-year-old daughter.
Right, like so many people. And as you say, the streets of Xi'an are deserted. How are residents handling being stuck indoors in the city?
So those who can are working from home. schools have all gone back to online classes. And one of the women I spoke to, Shi Xiaojin, she told me the lockdown was quite sudden, and so some people panicked at first. There were stories going around about people trying to escape Xi'an. One guy rode one of those public shared bikes for 8 hours in the middle of the night, and another one walked for days. Remember, Xi'an is in the north, so it's very cold there right now. But, you know, 8 days in, people are mostly resigned to staying at home for the common good. People told me they expect the lockdown to end when there are no new cases and all patients have been sent home.
Rebecca, I'm wondering if China is showing any signs of reconsidering its zero COVID policy. I mean, I guess that would mean loosening things up a bit, right?
Yeah, Marco, I think the government is doubling down on its approach. There are massive quarantine centers being set up, and a team of health experts this week suggested that border regions create buffer zones to prevent any spread of COVID over land borders. So I don't think that they're going to be loosening up anytime soon.
The World's Rebecca Kanther speaking with us from Shanghai, updating us on the latest lockdown in China in Xi'an. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Across the globe, governments are struggling to find the right balance between emergency pandemic restrictions and keeping their economies up and running. Here in the U.S., the CDC now recommends an isolation period of just 5 days if you're infected with COVID. In Europe, though, the rules remain very different, as the world's Orla Barry reports from London.
Quentin Wind runs Comptoir Gourmand, a French bakery in southeast London. The place employs 35 people. But COVID is starting to take its toll.
We have about two that are isolating due to close contact. One of our staff who works for us part-time, and she went back to Portugal for Christmas, and unfortunately she contracted COVID. So it is challenging.
Wynne tells me he's lucky. Not too many of his workers are off sick just yet. That's not the case with some bars and restaurants nearby.
There's actually quite a few that had to close down. Even one yesterday, a pizzeria that couldn't open his restaurant and only had to do takeaway because he didn't have enough floor staff. So, yeah, really hard for them.
In England, people who test positive for COVID must self-isolate for 7 days. And they can only leave quarantine if they produce a negative test result on day 6 and day 7. Business owners like Quentin Wind want the British government to follow the US and make the mandatory isolation period only 5 days. But Chloe Smith, the UK Minister for Disabilities, Health and Work, told the BBC that's not likely.
There are no current plans in England to change that period. Of course, we have actually only recently taken it down from 10 to 7, and we want to make sure that that is working as we believe it ought to. But we think the current period, therefore, is the right one.
As Omicron cases shoot up in many countries, the US is an outlier. Top epidemiologist Anthony Fauci told CNN this week he thinks the 5-day quarantine makes sense.
One of the things we want to be careful of is that we don't have so many people out. I mean, obviously, if you have symptoms, you should not be out. But if you are asymptomatic and you are infected, we want to get people back to the jobs, particularly those with essential jobs, to keep our society running smoothly.
But not all scientists agree with the American approach. Lawrence Young is a virologist at the University of Warwick.
I think it's a very risky strategy, and people can remain infectious for different periods of time. So I think giving some flexibility and margins around 7 days is important. And I think a 5-day period is, in my view, cutting it a bit fine, actually.
Isolation rules are generally more strict across Europe. In France, people with COVID must self-isolate for 10 days. In Germany, it can be up to 14 days, while in Spain, health authorities are following the UK's lead and cutting quarantine to 7 days. Virologist Lawrence Young says all the different rules are not helping.
You're getting mixed messages from government, you're getting mixed messages from the scientific community like myself, and I can see how that really confuses people, and they might end up thinking, well, what's the point in even worrying about this, and indeed, what's the point of getting boosted?
But in much of Europe, the biggest worry right now is skyrocketing infection rates. French Health Minister Olivier Véran yesterday called the number of new daily infections dizzying.
Les chiffres que nous enregistrons depuis quelques jours dans notre pays, j'aurais tendance à parler de raz-de-marée.
It's not a COVID wave, Véran said. It's a landslide. France recorded more than 200,000 new cases in just 24 hours. That's a record high in Europe. New Year's Eve celebrations in Paris are now cancelled. The fireworks in Athens, Berlin and Venice are all called off too. Here in England, though, Prime Minister Boris Johnson says people can still celebrate tomorrow evening.
I think everybody should enjoy New Year, but in a cautious and sensible way. Take a test, ventilation, think about others, but above all, get a booster.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Let's go back to one of the most controversial decisions made by the Trump administration, separating thousands of migrant children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. The policy was known as zero tolerance, and it was meant to deter unauthorized immigration. After what they went through, some of those families have sought compensation. The World's Daisy Contreras reports on how those efforts are going.
As soon as he took office, President Biden pledged to help reunite migrant families who'd been separated at the border during Trump's presidency. Here's Biden in February.
We're going to work to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration that literally, not figuratively, ripped children from the arms of their families, their mothers and fathers at the border.
Over 5,000 children were separated from their parents under Trump's policy. Some of the families who endured those traumatic separations sought out compensation. Biden agreed, and his administration started to negotiate an amount with lawyers helping the families, including Lee Gelernt, an attorney for the ACLU. At first, Gelernt says talks with government officials were productive.
And I think because the Department of Justice was taking a sort of cold-blooded look at the cases and realizing it made sense to try and settle them rather than go to court where the payouts might be much greater.
But then there was a leak. Media reports came out that family members could receive up to $450,000 per person. When reporters asked Biden about this, he seemed unaware of any specific agreement. But later, in a press conference, he agreed that some compensation was necessary.
You coming across the border, whether it was legal or illegal, and you lost your child. You lost your child. It's gone. You deserve some kind of compensation, no matter what the circumstance. What that will be, I have no idea. I have no idea.
After that, negotiations with the families stopped. Department of Justice officials didn't respond to an interview request, but they have stated that while they couldn't agree on a settlement, they remain committed to bringing justice to the families. Attorney Lee Gelernt says larger forces got in the way.
I think the only way to really understand why they broke down is politics, because so many people were pushing back on the families receiving compensation.
That, Gelernt says, is disappointing.
I hope that everyone recognizes that the United States has a moral responsibility to do right by these families.
But pushback on any payment to migrant families is clear, including from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
They want American taxpayers to pay out legal damages because of the conditions some people faced as they tried to break into our country illegally.
Other Republican lawmakers introduced bills preventing the government from making any payments to undocumented immigrants. They say it would only encourage more people to come to the U.S. without permission. But reparations are necessary for these families, says Catherine Hampton. She's with Physicians for Human Rights, a network of health professionals. She's tracked how families who've been reunited after being separated by the Trump administration are doing. She's found that many of the kids are still struggling with psychological trauma.
Still, you know, unable to sleep independently as they had prior to the separation, waking up screaming with nightmares, having difficulties in school, having difficulties going to the bathroom independently.
She says many of the kids will need intensive therapy, possibly for years. That can get expensive. Hampton says a cash settlement could help families cover those costs. But there's no guarantee that will happen, especially with the Biden administration ending talks over the payments. Still, many of the families are now determined to take their cases to court. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
A quick update on Sudan. The struggle for democracy there continues. Thousands of people in cities across Sudan marched today in protest of the military government. The authorities responded to protesters with tear gas and stun grenades in the capital, Khartoum. They've also shut down mobile and internet services across the country. Protests have been ongoing since the October 25th coup, which saw the military take power. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. In the northeast of Brazil, weeks of rain have caused massive flooding. More than 20 people are dead and tens of thousands have lost their homes. Michael Fox reports.
Roads out, cities underwater, rescue operations. These are the images that have poured across news feeds over the last week from the Brazilian state of Bahia. We're in the hands of God right now, says a man off camera in one video shared over social media as a rising river pours onto the bridge where he's standing. Bahia State Governor Rui Costa spoke to reporters after surveying the damage last Sunday. It's a gigantic tragedy, he says. I don't remember anything of this magnitude in Bahia's recent history for the quantity of cities and homes affected. It is really terrifying, he said. The floods have impacted over 500,000 people. More than 130 municipalities across the state are under a state of emergency. The situation has been made worse by the rupture of at least 2 dams that sent water flooding into already choked rivers and neighborhoods. I've never seen anything like this, says a man filming a torrent of rushing water shortly after one of them broke. So much water, he says. State officials say another 10 dams are at risk of rupturing if rains continue. Gabriele Sodré lives in Bahia and is a member of the movement of people affected by dams.
Essa é uma realidade das barragens do Brasil, principalmente porque grande parte delas...
She says this is the reality of the dams in Brazil. Only a small number of the country's 24,000 dams are inspected and monitored, in part because they're on private property.
Então, quando vem um volume de chuvas, além...
So when you have a volume of rain that is well above normal, these dams without inspections end up breaking, she says. According to the latest figures, 50,000 people across the state were forced to leave their homes. Many lost everything. But some neighbors are banding together, and community groups are responding.
Oi, gente, somos aqui da Aliança Comunitária. A gente está aqui na sede da Tabo com os voluntários.
Hi, everyone. We're at the headquarters putting together bags of clothes to bring to Uruçuca, says a young woman in a face mask in a video shared by the Community Alliance, a neighborhood group in a region hit hard by the rains. Behind the woman, a handful of volunteers fill black plastic bags with donations of clothes. Dozens of bags are stacked shoulder high along the wall beside them. Joselita Machado Lima is a longtime community member in the neighborhood of Bairro Novo.
Nesse momento, a gente está envolvido.
She says they've been working around the clock over the last week to provide support to those who have lost everything, delivering beds, clothes, and food. She says, there is so much need. Yesterday, when we were delivering donations, we saw that many homes are without furniture because the water rose really high. Scientists blame the weather pattern La Niña for the intense rains that have hit the state over the last month, as well as recent droughts around the country. Pedro Roberto Jacobi is a professor at the University of São Paulo's Energy and Environment Institute.
Fim das mudanças climáticas, que a tendência...
He says, with climate change, there is a tendency for these types of severe rains to happen ever more often. We have to look at the relationship between La Niña, extreme weather, and global warming, he says. The sun has shined over the last day or so, giving people a chance to start to pick up the pieces of their lives. But there is a long way to go, and more rains are expected in the coming weeks. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
It looks like, according to most projections, that COVID will keep many of us out of the office for the foreseeable future. Come March, I'll be heading into my third year hosting this show remotely. Occasionally, I go into the office, but mostly I and most of my colleagues are not in the newsroom. We're at home. Hard to believe this is the new reality. Since the pandemic, we've heard a lot about changes in the work environment, a big shift in people changing jobs or leaving the job market entirely. And with low unemployment numbers, economists suggest workers are gaining the upper hand and can dictate terms of employment. So will 2022 be the year of the worker? Tom Standage is deputy editor at The Economist and joins me now. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Can you flesh out some of the factors that suggest workers are in a position where they have more bargaining power than they have for a long time?
Well, there's a whole load of evidence that employers are having trouble filling vacancies right now. You know, everywhere you go, you seem to see signs saying help wanted. And the number of open vacancies has been hitting record highs in America. And employers have been having to put up wages in order to attract workers. And we've also seen people have been quitting their jobs in record numbers, which suggests they're pretty confident they're going to be able to find something better. So I think with many workers being able to work remotely some or all of the time, they can threaten to quit if they're not allowed to as well. So all of this sort of adds up to a world where workers have a lot more bargaining power relative to employers than they've had for many years.
So it seems the benefits and downsides of working from home will continue into the new year. But where does this leave those who cannot work from home? Will there be a rise in inequality and unfairness? And do the reported low unemployment numbers currently reflect that?
Well, I think we should remember that only about half the workforce in developed countries can work from home at all. So those of us like you and me, we depend on people like delivery drivers and people working in food processing plants and so on in order for us to be able to not go to work. And those workers, of course, are exposed to the virus and face risks that we don't if we're at home. So that's unfair right there. But I think in the longer term, there's another risk. As we see more work being done remotely, there's going to be this risk of the rise of inequality between people who go into the office more versus people who go into the office less. And surveys show that women and people of colour are less keen on returning to the office compared with white men. And the danger here is that people who go back to the office and are getting the FaceTime with the bosses and all that sort of thing, what's called presenteeism, so people who show up, they are most likely to get the pay rises and to get the promotions. And that could mean that if you've got more white men going back to the office, relatively speaking, that companies go backwards on things like the gender pay gap, on gender equality, on diversity and inclusion. And this is something that Iris Bonnet, a behavioral economist at Harvard, has been studying closely, and she has real concerns about it.
I am particularly concerned about gender inequity at work in this virtual world, because already we're seeing from surveys that women will be more likely to take employers up on the offer to work virtually or remotely as compared to men. And of course, if we still fall prey to presenteeism, where we value people's presence in the office per se, independent of their outcomes, or more importantly, take it as an indicator of performance, then that might actually impact women negatively.
That's really fascinating, this presenteeism issue. Is this an American phenomenon, Tom, or are we seeing a similar trend in other developed countries?
Oh, no, presenteeism, there's evidence from all over the world that presenteeism is a thing. The most famous cultures for it are, it's probably Japan. So in Japan, you know, it's sort of an iron rule that you have to get to the office before your boss and you have to leave the office after your boss. So you give the illusion to your boss that you're always at your desk. There's a sort of a whole cluster of sort of problems with people overworking because of this obsession with presenteeism. One of the nice things about remote working is, in theory at least, people can judge you on the quality of the work that you do rather than just whether you're at your desk or not. In practice, we may not actually see that happening. We may see presenteeism, you know, continuing to be a problem.
Tom Standage is host of The World Ahead, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. Tom, thank you very much. Good to speak.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. The year 2021 had to sum everything up in just 100 photos.
The ideal picture that we want is one that says the whole story in one photo, and it's not always possible.
Still, Reuters chose the best of the best to try and do just that. Coming up, a photo editor on some of the winners, images capturing a year of tragedy and resilience. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Across the country, Chinatowns have been reeling from COVID illness and economic devastation from the pandemic, while residents and businesses have faced violent attacks and anti-Asian hate. In Chinatown in Los Angeles, some long-simmering internal conflicts also emerged. Reporter Quincy Surasmith takes us to LA's Chinatown to hear two different visions for the neighborhood's future.
Most people in Los Angeles, unless they're actually from Chinatown, mainly think of it as a place to get a meal, or as a setting for TV shows and film noir movies. But it's a real neighborhood, with residents, businesses, and a lot more going on than you might imagine. Now, I'm not from Chinatown. I didn't grow up there. Though I am Asian American with Thai and Chinese heritage, my family had no connection to the neighborhood. But over the last dozen years, Chinatown's really grown on me as I've spent time browsing, eating, and hanging out with friends there. So when the pandemic hit, I was worried about the neighborhood. In addition to the sickness and deaths, many people didn't have food and basic supplies. Renters were worried about getting evicted from their homes, and there was talk about Chinatown businesses at risk of closing permanently. But the thing is, a lot of those problems had been brewing for years. What COVID did was add to existing tensions.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Quincy.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
There's one person whose vision can be seen throughout the neighborhood. To understand what's going on in Chinatown, you have to understand him.
My name is George Yu. I'm the executive director of the Chinatown Business Improvement District since its founding in 2000.
The Chinatown Business Improvement District, or BID for short, has a mission to bring about Chinatown's economic and cultural rebirth.
Part of what we're trying to do is to make Chinatown sustainable.
When George says we, he's really referring to himself. The Chinatown Business Improvement District is kind of a one-man show.
You know, I came from a private business background. I don't have a nonprofit with a bunch of people sitting around. This is it.
He started working with his dad as a contractor in Chinatown in the 1970s, and he's maintained both a familiarity with the neighborhood and an instinct of always looking for things to fix.
I've been in Chinatown since 1976. There isn't a merchant that's been in existence that I probably don't know and have some working relationship with.
George is the kind of guy who's hard to reach and stays busy. He's constantly checking incoming texts and emails, or going through thousands of pictures on his phone. Pictures of old properties, new developments, and various homeless people, all of which he feels the need to stay on top of.
Here's a photo of Project Room Key. Still there.
George Yu is at the center of a conflict that has been brewing for years. What kind of businesses and people deserve to be in Chinatown? Should the focus be on attracting new businesses and development? Or should the priority be supporting long-time residents, many of whom are poor and in need of assistance?
In order for Chinatown to be sustainable, you need a balance of new and old businesses, of young and old residents.
When the pandemic was at its worst here in LA, there were all these calls to support Chinatown businesses. There were Instagram posts asking people to order takeout when they couldn't dine in, and Google spreadsheets with lists of small businesses to patronize. But that was over a year ago. I asked George Yu about how Chinatown businesses were recovering and if any had closed.
Well, you keep mentioning closure. You know, let's talk. Give me an example of a business that's closed in Chinatown. Certainly the pandemic introduced new challenges for all businesses. Was there any challenges that could not be overcome? I don't believe so. You look at a business like One Kok. They have a line now. They didn't have a line before the pandemic.
One Kok was a restaurant I knew well. The interior was super old-school Chinese-American. Red vinyl chairs, dragons adorning the support posts, dim sum dumplings and buns at the front counter still steaming away late into the night. I was glad a classic Chinatown spot like One Kok had survived the pandemic. But George wasn't only pointing to older businesses like One Kok as an example of how well Chinatown businesses are doing.
The older businesses are, by and large, ready to retire. Without younger business coming in, then there's no future.
George has a reputation for courting new restaurants to Far East Plaza, the shopping center George's company Mako owns and manages. These included restaurants run by star Asian American chefs, or ones that would soon become stars.
Food is a great equalizer in terms of bringing people in. You have a lot of young Chinese and APIs opening up businesses, and I think that's the only way Chinatown will be sustainable.
Pearl River Deli is one of the newer successful restaurants in Far East Plaza. I caught Chef Johnny Lee on one of their prep days. It was just him and three other young cooks preparing the week's menu. Johnny was tending to a wok over a big fire, while his team packed supplies and blended chili sauce. Johnny opened Pearl River Deli in February 2020.
I mean, we barely had a month until the shelter-in-place order in March came down. And originally, it was intended just to be a pop-up. After Chinese New Year, that's when the shelter-in-place order really came through. That's when everything started getting very slow and everyone started closing down. But we decided to just kind of keep it China.
Pearl River Deli's been able to keep operating because they can afford to run lean with a small team, limited hours, and being flexible with their service and menu offerings.
Because we're a small restaurant, we're able to maneuver fairly fast. And, you know, because I'm here every day and I'm making decisions.
Pearl River Deli recently announced that they're moving into a larger, more permanent space in Chinatown. But not all businesses are doing so well. A little over a block away on a less busy street, Zenmei Bistro is going through a much harder time. When I went to speak with them, even though they were open for business, the door was locked. When they let me in, the restaurant was empty. And over the course of an hour, they only seated 2 tables. And this is where I started to understand that George Yu's idea of sustainability might not be working for everyone. Zenmei Bistro's owner Michelle told me how things were going. She explained that their sales are down about 80% since the pandemic started. Before, they were running with 4 employees, mostly family members. They've reduced down to 2, and even that still feels like too many. When places like Zenmei have to scale back, it doesn't just impact the restaurant. The people working as cooks, servers, and bussers are also affected. I feel sorry to have to tell them they can't work here anymore, she explained. Stories like Michelle's are a major focus of a group called Chinatown Community for Equitable Development. CCED thinks about the neighborhood in a way that's radically different from George Yu and the Chinatown Business Improvement District.
If we want to talk about violence, ask yourself, are we making the same noise and paying attention when our elders and families are being evicted from their homes? Especially during a pandemic.
In March 2021, a rally called Love Our Communities gathered dozens of community organizations, including CCED, and hundreds of people in the Little Tokyo neighborhood to address violence and hate against Asian Americans. Tito, an organizer with CCED, talked about the connection she saw between the rise of anti-Asian violence during the pandemic and the drive to bring new development to Chinatown at the cost of existing businesses and longtime residents.
When our full-service grocery stores are pushed out, where does that leave our elders? How can our elders be safe when what they need around them is destroyed? This is the economic violence that our working-class Chinatown community has faced. This is what happens when an influx of luxury developers and city politicians value profit over people.
CCED started in 2012, rallying against the opening of a Walmart in Chinatown. They grew to do tenants organizing and protest new developments in Chinatown. When the pandemic came, they pivoted to bring food, supplies, and financial assistance to elderly residents and others without access. Meeting with CCED organizers is very different than meeting with George Yu. They tend to work in small groups and committees. The organizers I met with are in their 20s and 30s, though their full membership ranges in age from teenage volunteers to elder tenants of senior housing in Chinatown. While George had spoken enthusiastically about businesses that are thriving, CCED regularly interacts with businesses at the margins, the ones struggling to make ends meet. Janice Yu is one of CCED's organizers.
We headed over to Dynasty Plaza, which was kind of our big outreach spot for the day because they were recently purchased by Redcar, which is this developer that displaced folks from the shop and tore it down. And so there's this looming threat of them displacing those same tenants again, displacing everybody in Dynasty Plaza, and it's the last remaining shopping mall in Chinatown.
While Janice describes the developer Redcar as a looming threat to Chinatown, George Yu takes credit for bringing them in.
You know, Redcar, at my request, purchased Dynasty Center or some of these newly renovated buildings by Redcar. Take a look at the transformation from a building that was abandoned, you know, to all new, retrofitted, ADA upgraded, you know, and it's just beautiful.
But George's idea of beauty is not shared by everyone. The community organizers at CCED put a post on Instagram sharing some words from Kenny, who owns a shop in Dynasty Plaza.
A lot of shopping centers in Chinatown have been taken over by a big group of the buyer, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they try to purchase the Asian shopping center and try to convert them into like office use or apartment. Mm-hmm. So if they keep doing this, so in the near future, maybe in the next few years, there's no more Chinatowns.
Businesses like Kenny's rely on Chinatown neighborhood regulars. Older people, immigrant families, locals who don't speak English or maybe don't even speak Mandarin, which is the more dominant Chinese language in other parts of the city. In recent years, shopping malls and plazas in Chinatown, such as The Shop and BC Plaza, have evicted commercial tenants or closed down under new ownership.
I think the reason for it ultimately was that the building was uninhabitable, but it was uninhabitable because of conditions that he had created. Like yeah, not paying for the electricity and soldering bathrooms closed and yeah, tactics like that.
CCED is fiercely protective of the community members they're close with. They've held demonstrations protesting poor living conditions of elder renters and organized coupon booklets to support struggling restaurants like Zenmei Bistro. They are equally passionate in their criticism of new businesses and development that they see as a threat.
What it's going to take is for these businesses and gentrifiers, residential or commercial, to feel uncomfortable. They were actually invitations that took a lot of care, I think, to invite these businesses to really critique themselves.
They've been kind of criticizing a lot of newer restaurants, a new younger generation coming in, trying to do things, like accusing us of enabling gentrification.
That's Johnny from Pearl River Deli.
I don't really agree with their methods, because especially if they're, I assume they're also Chinese Americans, like many of us are. I don't think it's very productive for Asians to be criticizing each other and instead of being productive and trying to find solutions together, you know, especially in this era of increased anti-Asian discrimination, you know.
I can see where Johnny's coming from. It took time for me to feel invested in Chinatown and to care for its people. And that happened because I found people and places in Chinatown where I felt like I could belong. If newcomers are criticized and feel unwelcome, would it discourage them from caring about the neighborhood the same way? But I have to admit, my interactions with CCED have also actively shaped my personal investment in what happens to Chinatown and made me reflect on my own role in the neighborhood. And no matter how much I care, I'm still mainly there as a visitor. For people who live and work there every day, their struggles and realities can't be put on pause, especially when the pandemic's impact is still being felt. As I walked with the group back to their office, they pointed out how bad things had gotten for businesses in Chinatown.
We're walking past Plum Tree Inn now, which is this legacy restaurant that was around for decades and actually had to close permanently during the pandemic.
This was actually one of two tours of Chinatown I had taken. The other was with George Yu. He drove me around, pointing out all the legacy businesses and organizations, like Chinese family associations, that are still in the neighborhood.
I'm pointing these out because these are all buildings that will never change, that will never be sold. That concern about that kind of change, fundamental change, is a little overblown.
George admits that some businesses had been leaving Chinatown even before the pandemic, but he argues they were just following their customers who had moved out of the city to the suburban communities that have become new centers of Chinese and Asian American life. But a lot of people still call Chinatown home. These include businesses that have been there for decades. And many Chinese and Southeast Asian immigrants from working class and refugee backgrounds still look to Chinatown as an affordable place to live, work, and start new lives. Those shifts in Chinatown lead us back to the core question being so hotly debated. Who is Chinatown for? For George Yu, the answer is obvious.
Anybody's vision should be those with skin in the game. If you own property in Chinatown, you own a business in Chinatown, you live in Chinatown, you know, you're the property owner and you're legally entitled to build or not build something.
And this is something George kept going back to. He comes from a property management and contracting background. He believes in property owners and their right to literally build a prosperous Chinatown on their land. But not everyone is a property owner, as Janice at CCED points out.
Their actions are creating a Chinatown where the most vulnerable folks, working class folks, can no longer thrive. And so I think there's a tension there where they are actually destroying this community in a lot of ways. I think back to the roots of Chinatown as this place that was for working class folks, working class immigrants, to really thrive. And so I think that we want to continue to honor that vision of Chinatown.
Both BID and CCED see themselves as advocates for longtime Chinatown residents and business owners. They both see themselves as insiders, working to let Chinatown determine its own future instead of being told what to do by outsiders. The problem is, they fundamentally disagree on whose voices and interests are important and who actually needs help. For Chinatown, there is no pre-pandemic stability to return to. Only a question. A question they've been putting off that can't be delayed much longer. Who gets to decide the fate of our neighborhood? For The World, I'm Quincy Sursmith in Los Angeles.
The story comes to us from the news organization Feet in Two Worlds and their podcast A Better Life, exploring how COVID-19 has changed immigrants' lives. President Biden hopped on the phone with Moscow this afternoon. He spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin for the second time this month. At issue, the buildup of around 100,000 Russian troops along its border with Ukraine. Kremlin officials want fresh guarantees from NATO that it won't expand the military alliance eastward into Ukraine. The West wants Russia to de-escalate. Putin's spokesperson said he's in the mood for conversation. Biden is reportedly countering with a diplomatic path forward. The old expression, a photo is worth a thousand words, it's so true, which means in this eventful year, there's a lot to say because there's so much that we saw. A mob rushing the U.S. Capitol, an Indonesian man on a ventilator, a Norwegian hurdler winning gold at the Tokyo Olympics. Subjects of some of the best 100 photos this year is chosen by Reuters. Joining me now is Ricky Rogers, a global photo editor with Reuters Pictures. He joins us from Pittsburgh to talk about this year's photos of the year. So, Ricky, what do you think this year's photos say about this chaotic past 12 months? What story do they tell?
I think they say that in spite of a constant sort of single story of COVID again this year, that the world was still as crazy as any other year, and there were so many stories going on that surprised us even in a year what we didn't expect them.
I mean, that's what I pulled away. What really struck me is just kind of the massive pressure the whole globe is under right now as you look through these 100 photographs, whether it's through dangerous and divisive politics or climate change or disease. I don't know how long you've been in the photo editing business, but how would you compare this year to past ones in terms of capturing it in images?
Well, I've been in for 31 years now, and it was a year that we expected actually to be past COVID and to carry on with what we consider the story of our lifetimes, which is climate change. We were surprised in January 6th, very early, with violence and the attack on the Capitol. And then we had so many more migration stories that we have every year, but they were even worse this year, and partly maybe because of COVID in some places. We had difficulties accessing several countries that we haven't had in the past, Myanmar, China, Afghanistan, obviously. So it was a very, very busy year, as always, but it was a complex one because we had the constant challenge of covering COVID across everything, and it affected our lives.
I will ask you about COVID and some of those pictures around the pandemic. First, just your favorites, and I kind of hesitate using that word because some of these shots are beautiful and disheartening at the same time, like this incredible shot in black and white of a man engulfed by a swarm of locusts on the top of a hill in Kenya. Really powerful. Can you point us to maybe a strong image that came into you that you just could not stop looking at?
Well, I think it's the aerial picture that we have from our late photographer, Danish Siddiqui, of the funeral pyres in Delhi, in India. It was a picture that became very controversial because it showed exactly what was going on, and it irritated a lot of sectors in India. But at the same time, it was celebrated widely.
Funeral pyres around the pandemic, correct?
Yes. It was a scene that nobody had photographed and seen really before. And Danish did that with a drone, which is an important part of our coverage nowadays, using technology.
And the photographer, you said, is no longer with us. What happened?
Danish was tragically killed in Afghanistan during coverage of the days leading up to their takeover of the country. It was in Kandahar.
Yeah, a clear illustration of some of the risks photographers take when they're out in the world.
Yes.
On the pandemic, I mean, it's created so many different narratives, from global inequities over vaccines to people angry they have to take them, and then there's the death toll, 5 million people plus at this point. I mean, what kind of challenge is that for a photo editor to kind of even to get it down to 100, and some of those are not going to be pandemic photos? I mean, how do you come up with that story?
We try to cover COVID all around the world and give it a local aspect photographically, and it's very difficult because an ICU looks the same everywhere. But there are aspects such as the one I mentioned in India, and we had a wonderful picture this year of a nursing home in Seattle, which was the first focus of COVID early in 2020, and of a family reuniting for the first time and a little elderly woman seeing for the first time her children. It was beautiful. So there are positive moments in it, but overall it was obviously, we know it's tragic for so many people.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about the people behind the photographs. You mentioned the tragedy of one of your photographers who died in Afghanistan. How have your photographers fared emotionally during a pretty tough year?
We have a very complex and a very good system of support for our journalists. and we're in constant contact with them whenever they leave a scene and before they go, obviously, to be prepared both in safety gear and whether it's PPE or flak vests and jackets and helmets and everything like that. It's one of the most important parts of our jobs right now.
So it can be hard for people to take these big stories like migration, the pandemic, climate change. Describe how a single photograph has a power to focus the mind.
The ideal picture that we want is one that says the whole story in one photo, and it's not always possible. It used to be much, much more demanding before we had internet and the digital media that allow us to show slideshows. In print media, we used to publish one picture or two on a big story. Those pictures had to say the whole story. It's about getting the right elements into the frame, but the aesthetics, obviously, are also very important. So we talk about a beautiful picture of a tragic scene, and we know that tragedy and misery are often so photogenic, but we need to do it in a responsible way that respects people, but portrays the emotions behind it and the real impact.
Ricky, I don't want to leave the impression that these 100 photographs are of a world mired in tragedy and misery. Can you leave us with a photograph that you love, a photograph of hope? What photograph inspires you in this selection?
I love this one picture of a worker drying fabrics in Bangladesh. It's just a stunning picture. And there is always an appetite in digital media for beautiful pictures that don't necessarily have to do with a news story behind it. The pictures of volcano in Spain were so beautiful, even though there are a lot of people affected. But the pictures are beautiful, and it just shows the power of photography at the same time.
Ricky Rogers is a global photo editor with Reuters Pictures. He joined us from Pittsburgh. What a year. Thank you very much, Ricky.
Thank you, Marco.
How does a rock classic like this get reworked into mariachi? The all-female mariachi band Flor de Toloache breaks so many molds when it comes to the style of music they play. To begin with, the band's gender. Also, they did not get their start in Mexico City at the mariachi mecca that is Plaza Garibaldi. They began busking in the New York City subway. Inspired by a wide range of artists, including 80s Argentine rockers Soda Stereo. That's Soda Stereo's hit De Música Ligera, considered by some as an anthem of rock en español. It translates, ironically, as light music. Now here's how Flor de Toloache recently reworked it. Ella durmió al calor de las masas y yo desperté queriendo soñarla. It's been a good year for the New York-based Flor de Toloache. They put out a new album this month. Earlier in the year, they were part of the Latin Grammy tribute to music legend Ruben Blades. Next year, a tour and a new album covering more rock classics with their mariachi spin. Las trampas del amor. If you want more of the music you hear on the show, come back tomorrow for our New Year's Eve edition. It is all music. We have got you so covered. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.